Hi, and welcome to another episode of Horse Sense. At Horse Sense, we give you practical, relevant, up-to-date, and even inspirational information to enrich your horsing life. If you're a first-time listener, a big hello and welcome to you. And if you're returning, thank you and welcome back. This show is brought to you by the Equine Care Clinic, a clinic dedicated to the care of sick or injured horses when their owners aren't able to. Check out the site at equinecareclinic.com for lots of great info and resources. I'm your host, Amanda Edwards, and today I'm talking to Steve Brinkworth of Horsemanship Essentials. This is a really cool chat to get behind the psyche of our horses and learn effective training hints and tips from a master horseman. Whatever your riding discipline, you'll find something that helps you here. Sit back and enjoy the ride. Hi, Steve, and welcome to Horse Sense.
Hi, Amanda.
How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you for having me on your show.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for being here. Okay, so perhaps if you can start with our normal thing of telling the listeners who you are, what you do, and how you got to be one of the most gifted trainers that I've come across.
Wow. Thank you. God, the pressure's on now. Well, as you know, we just said, I'm Steve Brinkworth. I've pretty much been in horses since about 79, when the family had a trail riding business.
Yeah.
So we were endurance riding, and we were teaching people how to ride and taking package holidays to the Flinders and doing all that sort of stuff. And we did that through to 1998, something like that, I think, until the insurance woes.
Yeah.
Came along for the industry and shut it down. And then, we weren't doing that because of all that. So I started helping people with their own horses.
Yeah.
And
they had to flip your business model, really?
Did. I mean, there are a lot of things that came about at that time, so it kind of worked in. But we just, I just put up some A4 sheets in Woodend and started helping people with their horses, and lo and behold, there's a lot of people with a lot of horse problems.
Yeah, and I think that, I guess that's how I met you. I had a horse that wouldn't go on a float, and
I do remember that black horse out in the middle of a paddock, I think.
He was indeed, and he was very, very resistant, and in fact, he'd actually tried to go through the front of a float, and he'd fallen over several times, and it was a nightmare, and I was needing rescue remedy to float him anywhere. And I was pretty impressed with the way that you managed to get that horse. He was pretty dangerous. He used to rush out of the back of the float. And you managed to get him to a point where he was self-loading and I could go more than a half an hour trip because it wasn't my night knuckle job.
Float loading and floating are pretty stressful things for people and horses.
They are. So you sort of get that kind of problem horse. You've done a lot of that, but I've also seen you start new horses as well, which is
a lot easier.
Yeah, a lot easier.
Yeah.
So going back a little bit, your treks to the Flinders Ranges, this has always been something that I'm very annoyed that I didn't get the opportunity to do. Tell us a bit about how those trips worked and what were the really cool things about those.
They were good fun. We had our own horses, so people weren't bringing along their own horses. Do 30, 40 k's a day.
Yeah.
On very rocky, hard country, up and down, pretty steep stuff. So the people came along and we were up in the Flinders and it was nice and it was pretty fun. At night, everyone would have a few drinks and after the hot day of riding and we had a lot of fun.
Yeah. So they were sort of 10-day treks. How many people did you...
Oh, the max was about a dozen.
Mm. So I guess you get to learn a lot about horses and a lot about people out on those trips.
We did. But one of the things that I realised even back then was we managed horses. So there were horses that would pull back and there were horses that were head shy and there were ones that you couldn't bridle and there were ones that didn't go on the float and we just managed them.
Yeah.
We didn't fix them.
Yep. Do you think that's because, like, a lot of times we don't actually think we can fix those problems, or it doesn't occur to us to try?
Yeah, more you just think it's the horse is that way.
Yeah, yeah.
So he has that problem, and you just have to manage him. And it was only bit by bit that I realised that we could fix it.
Yeah.
And it wasn't really then that I worked it out. It was only later that I kind of started to work that out and work out why they did the things they did.
Yeah.
And what to do about them.
So, and I guess that those horses weren't, you know, you had a lot of horses, but they wouldn't have been highly trained horses that you were picking up when you got them.
So Dad was pretty tight. Sorry, Dad. But he...
So like Bill's not going to spend a lot of money on a horse.
$300 was top dollar. And when I was in Victoria and I said to him, oh, you know, horse is a couple of grand, and he nearly fell off his perch. Like, so no, they weren't highly trained.
Yeah.
But,
and so then you would have to kind of get them to a point where they'd be happy to not be silly out on a ride with a whole
miles bunch of under clients. The belt.
Mm.
I mean, that's what worked for us.
Yeah.
Is just miles under the belt, being loaded on trucks, going places, riding.
Mm.
And what I realised when I started doing this job is that that's not how it works for most people.
Yes, because we don't get much of a chance. And
you know, once a week. Yeah. A couple of times a week, once a fortnight, who knows? And the idea is it's supposed to be people's relaxation. It's supposed to be their time away from work or the kids or...
Yep.
And you want to kind of just come out and your horse loves you and you have a lovely ride out into the sunset and everything's good and you let your hair down a bit and you come back and you go back into your life of work or whatever.
Yeah.
But it turns out that horses add to people's stress.
Well, they can if they're not really going with that flow.
Yeah. A lot of people are kind of like, get back from a ride and it's kind of like, oh, I lived.
Yes.
Rather than, that was really relaxing.
Yeah, exactly. So now I know that you've spent lots and lots of years working with other trainers initially and learning different styles and really studying. One of the things that really I found really interesting was a lot of horse people that I know have a set way of doing things and they stick with that and they don't really continue to try and learn and develop and so forth. And so who have been your key influences over the years? I know you sort of go wide and, you know, you've really looked at lots of different trainers and taken a bit from here and a bit from there and put together your own framework, yeah, which we'll talk about in a minute.
I think if you come from a dressage point of view, dressage people are concentrating on physical structure.
Yep.
And that. And then if you go what they class as natural horsemanship, that's kind of from the psychological point of view.
Yep.
And what we've actually got to do is we've actually got to work from both points of view.
Yeah.
Psychologically, you've got to understand the horse and what motivates them and why they do the things they do. But you've also got to understand that they do a lot of things simply because of the structure that they're in. So for your listeners, that would be like if their head is up in the air, pushing up from their lower neck.
Yeah.
So their head goes up in the air and their back hollows. That posture says, I'm in danger, got to run away.
It also makes them hollow out in the very place that they're trying to carry a weight.
Yeah.
Which, in some of our places, is heavier than others.
I think one of the key things we've got to understand is that horses aren't designed to carry a burden. So, unlike a camel has a kind of a hump and its back goes up, so it's ideal for hanging things off and it doesn't collapse, whereas a horse, and especially as we've bred them bigger and longer and that sort of thing, where you sit is actually the weakest point and it collapses.
Yeah.
So that in itself, as you put the weight on, the back hollows, so the head goes up in the air, the horse says, I'm in danger, whether he's in danger or not. The posture dictates his mental state. So it dictates that I'm in danger. So he then goes into his instinctual behaviour of flight and fight.
Yep.
And I think where we, as in the trainers of horses, are missing some of the key things about horses is the instinctual behaviours aren't relevant and we can change them. And that's been scientifically proven in rats. So I don't need to go into the details, but you can instinctually change the reaction to a stimulus with rats.
Yeah.
And a horse is the same. So if we delete the fight and the flight and change that to focus and try, and then we incorporate that with structurally changing them so that they use their hind feet for balance instead of their head and neck and their front feet, we change everything about the horse, and suddenly you've got horses that would appear to be flighty and scared of everything that become confident and calm and relaxed, and their gait's really nice, and they don't injure themselves, their front legs don't collapse, all those sorts of injuries that we have don't appear anymore because the horse is mentally calm and physically calm.
And physically built in a way that's not going to put pressure on, or you're not building those muscles that are going to put pressure on tendons and ligaments.
Yeah, the wrong areas.
The wrong areas. So you've sort of touched on it a bit there, but can you sort of spell out the steps of your training framework? Okay. So
I can go through that pretty quickly, really. It's pretty straightforward. When I say straightforward, that doesn't necessarily mean it's the easiest thing in the world, because you've got an animal that's goes into flight as soon as he's not sure about anything. So, but basically, we first off put boundaries in place that teach him to not run over the top of us, to focus on us.
So the first step is focus, is that right?
Well, your first step really is safety. Just safety, make sure the horse isn't running over the top of you.
Yep.
And then when you do that, so you might say walk towards the horse and move it back. Well, once it moves back, it's probably going to leave. And at that point, it's mentally left and then physically it leaves. So now you put boundaries in place, and when it stops running around, it will look at you.
Yep.
So we don't want to run it around and around in circles. I just want to stop it and turn it until it faces me.
Yep.
And that's focus.
Yep.
So we make everything else uncomfortable, flight, and if he fights, I've made that uncomfortable as well. And that is what deletes that behaviour. So if you kind of nurse it and go quiet when they're in flight or fight, that actually enhances that behaviour, teaches the horse to do more of it. But if
is our natural bent, particularly as it might just be me, but as a woman, when the horse starts to get afraid, I get afraid because I'm not sure that he's not going to land on me. So it was quite a big flip for me to realise that actually by making it uncomfortable, and that's not by creating a complete storm or not punishing him, but by making it uncomfortable and teaching him to drop and relax and be calm, I trained that, because what I was doing was training the other. So if the horse was getting stressed, I'd stop. So I was training him to get stressed. And this is probably one of the things that I've learnt having done some work with you over these years. Hopefully I've picked up something. But it's actually, you know, it's a really big thing, is to just not quit just because the horse is getting stressed, because you're making him more stressed.
I think that's a hard concept for people to be confident to apply and also grasp.
Yeah.
That in actual fact, the flight and the fight and being scared is actually just a learned behaviour. They're offering you something.
Yes.
And it's just not the right answer.
Yeah.
So the right answer to begin with is just focus on me and try to work out what it is I want.
Yep.
Which is actually completely opposite of what they would normally do.
Yeah.
In the wild, you don't hang around and check it out and see what's going on. You just get the hell out of there.
Yeah.
So to change that for a horse is monumental, and it changes everything about the horse.
Yeah.
So they now become safer in the paddock. They don't hurt themselves. They don't run through fences, get tangled up, and make life worse. But it is a hard concept. We tend to reassure the horse when he's getting upset.
Yes.
And then, and kind of back off in that instance.
Mm.
Where in actual fact we want to go, no, being scared is not the answer. Focus. And when he focuses on us, that's when we should quit.
Yeah.
And reward him for that. And he learns very quickly.
And I'll have to say too that what we're talking about here is not going in all gung-ho and pushing that to the point where you are going to get injured. You're very safety focused.
Yeah.
And so you only do what's absolutely necessary and raise the phases, shall we say, or turn the volume up to exactly what that horse needs. So, and mostly that does the trick. So
yeah, and it doesn't necessarily have to be confrontational, because no. You can actually do it in a yard without a line on the horse.
Yep.
If the horse is running away, you might be clapping and yep. continue clapping in a rhythm while he's running away, and when he puts an ear on you, you could quit clapping.
Yeah.
And that's the same thing. You're making him uncomfortable when he's in flight and backing off when he gives you the right answer of focus. And it could be just that one ear. And then next time it could be an eye. And next time he could turn.
Yeah.
And that's still rewiring his flight and fight pattern. And you're not even got a line on him.
Because it shows that it doesn't have to be a lot. It just has to be something to get his attention. So after we've got focus, what comes next?
So we've got our safety, we've got focus,
mm-hmm.
and then we teach the horse to focus on the scary object, and in the first place that will be me, and we're going to get him to bring his hind foot under, and I've got to reiterate this, it's bring a hind foot under and lower your neck. Because without the hind foot under, the horse can't lower his neck without tucking his nose and arching his neck. So you've kind of got to shift the ribs, because the ribs are stuck to one side, which we haven't talked about, but like we're left or right-handed, a horse is stuck on a bend to the left or to the right, and generally it's on a bend to the left, so 95% of horses. So we're going to get him to flex his ribs and bring his hind foot under and release his neck while he focuses on the scary objects. That now gives us a chance to control his head and neck.
Yep.
So that, because most horses, when they move, they lift their head up from their lower neck muscles and activate their shoulders and pull themselves along.
And that's actually when you get a lot of fight. And also, I, having worked with a lot on the ground, doing what I do with the clinic work, if they've got their head and neck, they've got their shoulders, and they can push on you, jump on you, all those sorts of things that are not and you have very little control.
And they don't have any control.
Because they're going to win.
Yeah, and the thing that we don't get, I think, is the fact that the horse can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
He can't stop, because for him to stop, he has to bring a hind foot under.
Mm.
So when his head's up in the air and he's pushing and he's shoving and all that, he can't change what he's doing. So he's not deliberately trying to step on us or squash us, but he's in a forward, out of balance, out of my mind state, and he can't change what he's doing, because he doesn't actually have the skills, the mental skills, to make a different choice.
Yeah.
He can only do more of what he's doing until we, the trainer, teach him something different, which you yourself would have done on numerous occasions when you're having to teach, do injuries and that sort of stuff on people's horses. The first thing you teach is self-medicate, which is the focus, the try, and the lower the head, and then you can treat them.
Yep. And that's pretty much what I've used pretty safely and effectively. So
as soon as that head and neck, you've got some control over that and you've got a hind foot under, your horse has balance, both mental and physical. And now what's surprising, and this is what will get people, is the horse isn't fearful of that ginormous cut or wound on his leg, because his posture says, I'm safe. And you can actually touch wounds and do things. You don't have to sneak around. Because the horse isn't in a state of fear.
That's exactly right. It's quite amazing and very, very effective. And it makes certainly my life a whole lot safer. And I don't have to do things like put horses in crushes or twitch them or do all those use those restraint methods that I sometimes feel uncomfortable about.
And of course, when you restrain an animal that's in a state of fear, it's just going to hurt itself or us.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Probably more likely to be me. Mm. So that's the first three parts of that framework, of the framework. What's the next?
So now, once we've got control of the head and neck, the horse won't be able to move, which sounds odd. But once you take the horse's ability to tension its neck and activate its shoulders to move forward, the neural pathways aren't connected to its back feet.
Doesn't seem to know that they're there, does it?
Doesn't. It just keeps activating its lower neck muscle and trying to lift its head up and trying to reach with its front hoof. And once you can control that, you can actually teach it to use its back feet to activate movement. And once it knows that, and this is, I think, one of the real keys, is that when you're working a horse and the horse comes into moving correctly and engaging its hindquarters, it doesn't actually mentally know that it's using its back feet.
Yeah.
It's not going, I'm using my back feet and lifting my back and moving in a manner that carries this burden really well. So as soon as you stop doing it, the horse just reverts back to what he's always done.
Mm.
But once you actually teach the horse to move from those back feet and the horse goes, huh, I didn't know I could do that, and it starts to use its back feet, and you'll see this because the legs will wave around in a funny pattern and it's got no control, much like if a person's right-handed and they write with their right hand and you put the pen in the left hand, suddenly they can't write.
Actually, that's a really good analogy, because that's exactly what it looks like.
Yeah.
But it doesn't take them long.
Doesn't take them
to connect all the dots and start to move in. Like, I've seen some of the most, you know, upright, standard-bred horses that come in here looking very stiff and move like beautiful dressage horses.
It doesn't take long. And I think one of the things with horses is they're innately motivated by death.
Yeah.
So when you're a prey animal, well, humans are motivated by praise and recognition, and also more so by looking foolish. We don't want to look foolish in front of people. And that's neither good nor bad. It's just a human characteristic. You know, if we trip over on the pavement, we're not so much worried about, oh, did we hurt ourselves? We more look around to see if anyone saw us tripping over. Whereas a horse is unconsciously or subconsciously motivated by death. So when he's going, oh, shit, I'm not sure about this, there's an urgency for him to work it out.
Yeah.
Once his instinctual behaviour of flight and fight has been deleted as a preference.
Yeah.
So now his preference is focus and try to work it out. So now that becomes his instinctual behaviour. So when he's not sure, he tries to work it out. So as soon as he connects the dots to those back feet, he gets it very quickly.
Mm. And I think too, I wonder sometimes whether, you know, the horse that's had problems because it's been trained a certain way, when it gets retrained this way, it seems to stick because it really, it's like that's a fresh pathway. It's a fresh way of, and you're kind of almost rewriting the book. Because it seems to stay. Like I've seen lots of other retrained horses and kind of falls apart a little ways down the track, whereas this seems to stick.
It's, I think of it much like a computer. With computers, you put in a new program and it overwrites the old program, and it just follows those instructions. So when you do this, you are actually rewriting the programming of the horse. So you're rewriting his instinctual behaviours, you're rewriting how he uses his body to create movement, how he moves, everything about him, and you're actually put in place the instruction manual for him to follow. And once he has an instruction manual that leads to comfort and safety, or priority safety for a horse, it's a snowball effect. So he through being safe, so he lowers his head, brings his hind foot under, that enhances that feeling safety, so he does it more.
Yeah.
Because he feels good.
Yeah.
And so
and he keeps doing it. And now let's just stop on that point, because he feels good because his head is low, his muscles are soft, and from a physiological point of view, that's actually, he's releasing endorphins all the time that he's doing that, as opposed to when their head is up and their tight muscles are tight, they're producing adrenaline.
Yep. I can't scientifically back the endorphins and the adrenaline, but it would have certainly, from a understanding point of view, from a human understanding point of view, that would appear to be, you know, when their head goes up, if their head goes up being pushed up from their lower neck muscles and their back hollows, that would, you know, they're going into flight and they'll look terrified and they're snorting and carrying on. So adrenaline would seem to be the thing. And, you know, when their head lowers, their hind foot's under, their back lifts, their eyes go soft, you know, they're breathing, their airways open up because they're not all balancing on their chest. So the chest opens up, allows more air into the lungs. Their breathing is soft, their ears go soft, and also their head goes from side to side when they move instead of up and down.
Yeah.
And everything about them, the structure, like the ribs are soft. You know, you touch the skin and instead of it being bracy, it's soft. And even though they might be being athletic, they're not tension through the whole body. There's just tension in the muscles that are being used. The rest of the body is actually soft.
It's, and the mind's soft. Quite a big difference. And it is that whole... The other thing that I always find really interesting is that the body dictates the mind. And that's a really interesting concept, because if you think about the horse that's grazing, he's mooching along with his head low to the ground. So it stands to reason that when he's got a relaxed body shape, he's going to be, that's pleasant memories, it's pleasant feelings, all that sort of stuff. And the same goes for people.
Yeah.
You know, you can see people that look relaxed and people that look tense.
Yeah. And with
our body, and if we actually put those people into a body shape, that will change their mind as well.
Yeah.
That one was a big one for me.
Like with people, it's like play basketball.
Yeah.
So we look up.
Yes.
So teenagers have a tendency to slouch on the couch and then they feel depressed. And so play basketball, look up. And when we, that's like keep your chin up.
Yeah.
Is the same.
Actually, isn't that interesting? Keep your chin up.
Yeah. It's, so for horses, it's kind of a little bit opposite.
Yeah.
You know, we need them to lower, but...
But it's still the body.
It is
dictating how your mind feels and how you feel about things.
So posture, posture dictates state, both with humans and horses.
Yeah.
And one of the a tricky part with the horses is they can do, if the head's low, they can actually do a grazing walk and a trot, and that doesn't actually engage the top line.
That's right. So the whole long and low thing can get a little bit not engaged.
Yeah.
They're actually just swinging like a pendulum.
Yes, and they're not using that back line. Yeah. So they can, and if people put them into that posture, the horse works out very quickly how to use the muscles it's got to do what we theoretically have put in place instead of the muscles that I'm trying to work. So, because it's different muscle groups that will carry the burden of the rider and carry the horse from the back end
to the muscles that it uses. And I think that's one of the key features, is you're trying to actually build a solid muscle base to carry to enhance longevity of the horse.
Yeah.
Which is one of the reasons that I really like your training methods. They're all about creating a sound horse that lasts a long time instead of a horse that breaks down at the age of 15.
Yeah.
Which we've become used to thinking is normal for horses. But if you think about some of the classically trained dressage horses, some of the original show jumpers, they were competing at very high levels into their 20s.
Yes, for sure. And a lot of competition horses break down at 8.
Yeah.
And that's basically because if when we're young, we can use our bodies, we're athletic, we can kind of do things, that as we get older, we can't. I mean, for me, it's lifting things. Yeah. You know, when I was young, I'd just bend over and lift them and off I'd go.
Mm.
Well,
now you've got to think about it.
Yeah, it would have been much better if when I was young I did it properly with the correct muscle groups,
yeah,
because I wouldn't be paying for it now.
Mm.
Now I can't do the things I could do when I was young, and that's the same with horses. So when they get about 8, they just can't do things the way they could when they were 4.
Yeah, they can't get around the fact that the muscles aren't in the right spot.
That's right. And unlike us, who actually understand that it's actually better for us to use these muscles that we don't have, and so we try
we
to...
We can't kind of explain that to
no,
them.
The horse doesn't understand that it's actually better for him to work these muscles that he doesn't have. Mm. He's like, no, I've got these muscles. I'll just use these muscles that I already have.
All right. That's all cool. So where are we up in the framework now?
We've basically got our head and neck neutral.
Yep.
And we've got a hind foot under us.
Yep.
So now we're standing still and the horse doesn't know how to move.
Yep.
Because his head's not able to lift up, so he can't use the arms. At this point, we've moved the ribs and we get an inside hind foot to propel the horse forward.
Yep.
And then as quickly as we can, we get that movement and we just come back to stop. So from stop, we've got to teach the horse how to stop.
Yep.
So the horse doesn't know how to stop without putting its head up in the air and putting its weight on its front feet. So we've actually got to teach him once again that the back foot is the one that he puts under himself to brake with. And when we teach him that, he stops tucking his nose, tucking his chin, and arching his pole and bracing in his front legs.
And that helps build that nice muscle of neck that you want at the top of the neck as opposed to the braking at the pole.
Yeah, like kind of the second vertebrae tends to be the highest point, but it should actually be the pole should come right straight to the kind of the ears.
And then once you've got that as a foundation, you can bring on, your horse can be trained to do anything.
Absolutely. The foundation is what we're trying to create. It doesn't matter what type of horse it is, we're trying to create a ridden horse, which means a horse that can carry the burden of the rider. So it doesn't matter whether you're going to do Western pleasure, reining, whether you're going to do dressage, show jumping, whatever, or go for a trail ride. People tend to think trail riding's less stressful than dressage, but in actual fact, it's just as hard.
Mm.
The foundation for all those things is exactly the same.
Yep.
The horse has to use particular muscle groups to carry the burden the rider and himself, because now he's got to lift his shoulders from his back end and the rider and do walk, trot and canter.
Mm.
Left and right leads. And
now this all sounds like it would take a really, really long time.
That's the amazing thing. It doesn't actually take that long.
Yeah. So
8-10 weeks, you can really, really change a horse's mental state, but also you can completely change his muscle groups, what he's using. And of course, to start with, there's the wrong muscles are stronger, and the good muscles, so the muscles from the hind end through his top line, are not used to being used. And also the muscles along the side of the ribs are actually used to dragging the hind end forward.
Yep.
And now we're actually turning him around where those muscles through the ribs are actually having to be carry the front of the horse forward. So you kind of, it's completely opposite.
Yeah, it is a bit, it's quite challenging. It's quite different to the way we would have ordinarily thought about how to train a horse. And do you not think too, I'm going off on a side tangent again, but in Australia we've trained horses in a very short, confined, like we've broken horses in, leave them in the paddock until they're, you know, a long way down the track, and then they've already got muscles formed, we break them in, we start, you know, 6 weeks and bang, that's it, done.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, and I don't know that it's just Australia, but there's probably plenty of places, I don't know, but the concept of breaking horses in is get a saddle on them, get a rider on them, and pull to stop.
Off.
Yeah, pull to left, pull to right, and don't put your legs on. Like a lot of people will get a horse back from the breaker, and the breaker will say, "Don't put your legs on for a while," because the horse will go nuts.
Mm.
But it doesn't have to be that way. And unfortunately, when you do it that way, you're actually creating problems that you have to then spend a lifetime fixing.
That's the thing. And I think that what we probably should have said at the outset is that this is no buck training. So we don't, you don't do buck. You actually set the horse up in such a way that I've never seen one of them buck, even when they came here and that was their problem.
Yeah, look, bucking is an extreme reaction. It's an extreme death reaction. And there's no need to go there. Like, there's no need for a horse to be in that fearful state. The posture of the horse dictates that, and then the girth and the things make him feel even more trapped.
Yeah.
And so then he's in an instinctual behaviour of extreme death.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, if they move from their back end and are taught that, it doesn't take very long. In actual fact, we might have the saddle and the bridle and a rider and their first ride on in a starting clinic after 3 or 4 hours of a horse that's not even handled.
That's a really, the starting clinics that you run, it's such a great process too, because you've got horses at different stages so that you can demonstrate what you... Here's one we prepared earlier that can do it, and then you can move to trying that out. So that's a really great process. Does anyone else... I don't think anyone else does that in Australia. Starting courses?
Yeah, I don't really know. I mean, the problem with starting courses is people believe that some horses will buck and some won't.
Yeah.
And in actual fact, it's just posture. It's just the way the horse moves that creates the fear that causes them to buck. So if you teach them to move correctly in a way that is for carrying the burden of the rider, I mean, if you're a prey animal, you know, bucking when there's something on your back is a good idea. But they're not really necessary anymore.
No, not when they live the cushy lives that
they're not really in danger. And it's only we put them in a position that makes them feel that they need to buck.
Mm.
It's just something that we teach them and we don't need to.
So what would be the most common problem that people, horse owners, come to you with?
I think
you see lots and lots of horses go through this.
Flight loading is always one that people have a bit of trouble with. But just generally, it's like horses are jiggy on the trail, they won't stop, they pull on the bit, they shy, they prop. They get all antsy, won't leave other horses. I think that's generally the sort of thing that most people have the problem is. The horse gets scared and erratic and its behaviour starts to flip the rider out as soon as it goes by itself.
Yeah, I think a lot of the people that come are often people that have lost their confidence because their horse is, isn't it?
Yeah, I think when we're young, we tend to just ride them as fast as they'll go and we don't really stress about it.
I used to be one of those people. I'd be just like, ride anything, don't matter.
And then as we get older, maybe our brains kick in or we've got to look after kids or whatever. Or we've
realised it actually hurts when
you hit the ground. Yeah, well, it does. It starts to hurt more, I guess, when you hit the ground. And we don't want that anymore.
Mm.
And the beauty is, if the posture is right and the way the horse moves is correct,
it doesn't have to be that way.
It doesn't. They're not intimidated by the surroundings.
Yeah.
So they can leave and they're calm and relaxed because the posture dictates their state. Their head's up and their weight's on their fore and their hind's loose. They're scared of everything.
So what would you say to horse owners about how they might apply some of these methods to what they're doing at home?
Well, we don't want to make our horses escalate to the point where they're going to hurt themselves or you. Mm. So first off, you've got to set yourself up for success. So
I love that.
It's a good saying. Don't do things in a barbed wire enclosure.
Yep.
You know, if you're going to teach your horse to face up, say, without a rope on him, don't try to do it in a 100-acre paddock. Or a 10-acre paddock.
Unless you're really, really fit.
Yeah, unless you're really, really fit, because you want the horse to feel uncomfortable when it's running away.
Yeah.
So, and it doesn't need to be much. It can just be an electric tape fence.
Yeah.
You know, if you bring your horse in and you chuck him some hay and get him used to coming into a smaller in 20-step by 20-step pen, you can start teaching him to face up, and when he runs away, you put a little bit of pressure on him. Not so much that he goes nuts and jumps over fences and that, but just a little bit. And that will
Like you said, just a tapping of your leg.
Yeah, tapping of your leg. You can be clicking your fingers.
My daughter whistles.
Yep.
It seems to work.
Yeah, I find a lot of people can't whistle. I thought it was surprising, but a lot of people can't whistle. I like whistling because it's a good cue for horses to come over, for me to get on, to do all sorts of things in the paddock and that sort of thing. But, but whatever works, a bit of a stimulus that makes them feel uncomfortable when they're running away and taking the pressure off when they do the right thing. But I think people need to really sit back and go, what is it that I want my horse to do? So when I handle it, how should it be handled?
Yes.
And come up with a
plan. And actually notice.
Yeah.
One of the biggest things I had to deal with, as you will recall, is that I did not notice that my horse was forever creeping into me, and I didn't notice that he was actually standing all over me. I just kind of moved out the way.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Like, lots of people don't realise that they're being pushed by the horse. We want a horse to maintain gait and maintain direction. So if we point him in a particular direction, we'd like him to go straight. Now, of course, because his ribs are one way, he can't go straight. Mm. And we've addressed that in this topic. But we've got to start to realise where our feet are going.
Yes.
And get ourselves to have self-carriage and maintenance of gait, and not start running after the horses.
You could just call it mindfulness training instead of horse training. Maybe it's us that you're training.
Well, it is, but I think some people are a bit not realising that we have to do change ourself as to be better with horses. We kind of work on, like, people want the horse to trust them, but that trust, which is a human term, more comes about through consistency of behaviour of the human.
Yeah.
So humans are very emotional, and we're rushed by, got to go home, we've got a short time to do stuff with the horse, and then the horse is misbehaving, theoretically, and we get upset.
Yeah.
And we might get angry, and we get frustrated, and then our behaviour changes.
Yeah.
And, sometimes when we've got all day, we're all relaxed and calm. But then when we've got 20 minutes, we're frantic and in a rush. And the horse is like, whoa, what planet are you on today? And so that's where it doesn't know where it stands. So consistency, get rid of being emotional. Emotions come about because we're not sure about how to train the horse.
Yeah.
You know, we come to a bit of how do we handle that? I'm getting worried that the horse is going to go nuts.
That's quite true, actually, because when you've got tools in your toolkit, you don't feel... I used to, when I had, going back to Asher, the black horse, when I tried to get him on the float and it wouldn't work, I would be just like, I've got no more tools in my toolkit, and now this horse is winning and he's a bugger, and all I want to do is go to the clinic I booked in for, and I can't get there. And it escalates and escalates. But then when I had some strategies, I'd be like, okay, so he's not going on that way. Let's try this. Let's move this. Da-da-da-da-da. On he go.
Yeah.
So it was all over in 5 seconds because I wasn't getting myself been out of shape.
Yeah. And that's absolutely right. People just run out of solutions.
Yeah.
Well, I just don't know what to do to fix this problem. And horses are really good at putting in a behaviour that causes us to back off and leave them alone.
And actually, humans are pretty good at that too. I've learned a lot from this horse training business,
So they kind of make us deal with them in a smaller and smaller life.
Yeah, so
you
they
can't
kind
take
of...
them off the arena. You can't take them over there. You can't touch their leg, or you can't do this. Or my horse doesn't like. Yeah. And so the horse is setting up the scenario.
Yes.
And
before
kids
long,
do
he's
it.
Got you very well trained, yeah. Isn't he? See, we've got it all wrong. They're training us. We're not training them.
Yeah. So if people kind of think, how do I want this relationship to be? And you've got to teach your horse everything. Because in actual fact, he doesn't have any programming to do with us other than leave.
Yeah.
Because, unfortunately, we're a predator.
Yeah.
And they're a prey animal. So nature says don't have anything to do with them. And an example of that is like a human goes into the paddock to catch the horse, and the horse heads to the far corner.
Mm-hmm.
But the same human goes in with a wheelbarrow to pick up manure, and the horse is like bugging them and pushing the wheelbarrow over and won't get out of their way.
What is that about?
So that is that a prey animal detects a predator, detects because what the predator wants. Because you're
actually stalking him to get him to come.
Yeah. And so he's programmed to detect what the predator wants and do the opposite. So if the predator doesn't want him, he comes over. If the predator does want him, he leaves. Just does the opposite.
Well, there's a revelation right there, everyone. All right. So that's your framework in a nutshell, and some of the outcomes that you get are quite spectacular. So I think what would be the key message you would like to leave people with at the end of this interview?
The key message... I think the key message is that your horse is not how he is. He's not, oh, I'm scared of this or I'm scared of that. I don't like pine cones on the road or whatever it may be. It's just his posture is dictated, his state, and so his behaviour comes about because of that.
So he's and actually not change. Out to get you.
He's not out to get you, and it's not personal.
Yeah, it's not personal. That's a great key message. Yeah.
You can change everything about your horse, and the horse will appear to love you for it. In our world, the things he does...
Which is what we like.
We will conceive of them as having a bond and loving us.
Yes, that is exactly right. Mm. We do like that. I particularly like that.
Yeah. You can train your horse to look at you and prick his ears up.
And even give you kisses.
It will bring tears to our eyes.
Exactly. It's lovely.
And it will come out and we'll go, oh, I enjoyed going and seeing my horse.
That's right. It makes us feel good. So, Steve, a couple of things. So where can people find out more about you and your training methods?
They can have a look on stevebrinkworth.com. So that's just our kind of website with general information. There's also Steve Brinkworth Membership, which has videos of me doing things with various horses, right? Yep. From feeding through float loading, training the muscles, training the rides, doing first rides, everything you can think of. And there's
which
also...
is really great for those people, because some of the people that tune into us are people who are in remote areas. Yeah. So for people who aren't in Australia or aren't in Victoria or can't get to a clinic or a starting course, the membership is really brilliant.
Yeah, so as long as they've got an internet connection that's half reasonable, they can do that. And that's really cheap. I think it's like $7 for a week and then $25 or something a month.
Very reasonable.
Yeah, and then there's also a USB as well, which has, if you haven't got an internet connection, that'll play on a TV or you know, a DVD player or anything like that.
So then you've got it, you can reference back to it, which is really great. So, okay, so that's a really, I think that's a wrap, Steve. So thank you very much for being on Horse Sense today.
Thank you, Amanda, for having me.
Cheers, bye.
Some horse training gold right there, folks. I enjoyed that chat very much, and I've chosen three key takeaways that I got from this interview. Number one, starting and retraining horses doesn't need to involve buck or bolt. There are alternatives, thankfully. Number two, change the horse's body and you'll change his mind to create a calm working state. Number three, working from behind or the hind needs to be taught. It doesn't just come naturally. I'd love to hear what you thought about this interview and what you took out of it. You can hit Steve up on his Facebook page, stevebrinkworth.com, or find more info on his website, which is also stevebrinkworth.com. Links to his page are in the show notes at horsesenseshow.com. And if you like this show, please head over to iTunes and leave some listener feedback. I really appreciate it, and I'm going to be reading out comments on the show going forward. Until next time, may your horsing be great horsing, and goodbye.